Okay, so I will talk a bit about the term or concept of reproduction concerning Marxist feminist theory, and I will specifically talk about the German situation. So my paper is a bit not all over the place, but I will start with lining out what the concept of reproduction comes from. Then I will go into more or less political or sociological analysis of the biological reproduction politics in Germany, and at the end, probably, I will give a perspective on what's going to happen with the commons or communization, and I think this links to probably the panel where Maya sits on, and I think it's an ongoing discussion. So if I talk too fast, just stop me, and I'm sorry for my sort of minor English. English is not my mother tongue, and so if something is unclear, just ask. Okay, so in the classical...
And I'll stutter it for you in English.
Yeah. So reproduction, the term of reproduction in classical political economy or national economy, it was pretty much evident that economy is first and foremost the science of the modi of reproduction, of social formations, of goods, or more general, of the means of need satisfaction, and therefore of the reproduction of the people. This is what Smith called the wealth of nations. In classical political economy theories, this wealth, even in the form of money, was mainly dealt with as a means of material reproduction. The value of commodities was thought in direct correspondence with its use value. While in Smith theory, the reproduction of the market through an invisible hand implied, as so to say, an automatic reproduction of the whole social formation, or that the product would be naturally distributed under the classes, other later theories disavowed the presuppositions and this automatism. Hegel, for instance, was very well aware that the bourgeois society, with all its wealth it is producing, does at the same time and necessarily produce increased poverty. Hegel did not believe in a self-reproducing economy, nor in self-reproducing capitalism, therefore, but left the organization of the conditions and preconditions of production to the corporations, the police, and the state. It became obvious that the end of production, neither of the particular productive capital nor of the end and the sort of goal or aim, neither of the particular productive capital nor of the total social capital is the reproduction of the whole, neither as a conscious aim of the capitalists nor as an unconscious invisible hand. Reproduction of the whole became a theoretical problem. Marx pointed out that the dual character of reproduction of current social formations, in the same sense as there is a dual character of the commodity as value and use value, and of wage labor producing value, producing use value. Reproduction in societies in which the capitalist mode of production prevails is always and necessarily a reproduction of capital, extended reproduction, because without extension it wouldn't be capital, and B, material reproduction of goods, means of production, and the people. Precisely that notion, that the class relation is an appearance of this particular mode of dual reproduction of the social whole that depends on capital and wage labor and ensures the false unity of the process, this notion has gotten out of sight for long times in Marxist politics and reception in Germany, and probably from the beginning on. On the contrary, what was focused was the simple antagonism of classes without the mediation developed here, mediation by the state, mediation by material reproduction. So therefore, the notion of the social coherence, its false unity in the heart of the antagonism, was not elaborated on anymore. A notion that is a necessary precondition for adequately understanding capital reproduction. Though the schemes of reproduction in volume 2 remained in classical Marxism a recurrent point of departure, but this did not turn into an understanding of the dual character of reproduction and the material implications of the conditions for living in societies in which the mode of capitalist production prevails. Rather, theory twirled around the question if capital is able to reproduce itself at all on the long term, or if it is doomed from the beginning and will die by its own proceeding. Reintroducing reproduction as a field of struggle, especially on common goods, seems to nowadays reintroduce a dualism between productive labor, surplus value, and capitalist reproduction, and unproductive labor, use value, and non-capitalist reproduction. Official left politics in Germany, I'm particularly talking about the Social Democrats, the party Die Linke, the left, the Social Democrats, and the Green Party, but also civil rights movements and autonomous groups such as FELS. FELS is Für eine linke Strömung, for a leftist Strömung is like...
current.
Yeah, current, exactly. Dedicated themselves to a defensive policy which is arguing for common goods against privatization. Here, reproduction was not contested as a sphere which is reorganized and reshaped by the state to secure the material reproduction under capitalist regimes, nor was reproduction fully lifted from privacy and transposed into the political. These politics resulted in an essentialist rhetoric of sustaining life as such, nature as such, needs as such. It did not open up a debate of discussing and interpreting needs. One could grasp this policy in part as a strategy to re-enter socialist consciousness in an era of neoliberalism, but it is exactly my point that this is a strategy which is weak and a false means to an end which is never debated nor envisaged. The argument communist critique would abhor people might have its legitimacy after the Soviet Union, but none of the populist counter-radical strategies were very successful until now. They risk instead identification with a strong sovereign that is based on exclusive communities, such as the nation-state. Particularly amidst a crisis that manifests itself not so much as a crisis of social capital or of a crisis of the reproduction of capital, but as increased unemployment, exhaustive labor, impoverishment, and in Europe, nationalistic responses like in Greece and Hungary, partly in Greece, not all of the movements are, of course, nationalist. So the reassessment of reproduction differs in many significant points from the early feminist critique of reproduction and its legacy today. But if we want to actualize these politics, the old autonomous politics, we should equally be aware of the limits of reproduction and in particular of its alleged subject, women. Federici points out that, I quote, reproductive work was formally subsumed to capitalist accumulation. It was only in the late 19th century that domestic work emerged as the key engine for the reproduction of the industrial workforce organized by capital for capital. That is, the situation of a working class almost unable to reproduce itself, averaging a life expectancy of 20 years of age, dying in its youth of overwork. The housewife emerged in the transition of products from absolute to relative surplus. Housework, Federici and Dalla Costa, amongst others, maintained it is not a free activity, it is the production and reproduction of the capitalist most indispensable means of production, the worker labor force. As such, it is subjected to all the constraints that derive from the fact that its product must satisfy the requirements of the labor market. I quote, today we are confronting a sphere of sexual... Today we are confronting a sphere of sexual reproduction which is constantly reorganized and disorganized by the state. Real subsumption points to the historical reorganization of labor, namely the transition from manufactural labor to machine work. Apart from understanding real subsumption as a single historical moment that characterizes the development of the capitalist mode of production, real subsumption stays with us up to now. It confronts us everywhere where relative surplus is produced and where capital tries to reconfigure labor processes under its command in terms of productivity, surplus, and intensity. So Federici mainly focused now, maybe we can discuss this on primitive accumulation, writing about the third world where she sees the disappropriation of land, for example, as an ongoing primitive accumulation. So she has the same point that primitive accumulation is not a single event in history, but it is necessary for capitalism to reproduce because it always relies on sources it does not produce by itself. So reproduction of the labor power remained in Marx a problem of the market and the availability and distribution of commodities such as housing, clothing, food. Federici and others argued that domestic labor, such as the preparation of food, emotional recreation, and sexuality, is absent in Marx's critique of political economy. Feminists now should contribute to a political economy of reproduction, not against, but with Marx. So also Federici has makes sort of an historical argument why Marx was not aware of feminist critique of the critique of political economy, because he envisaged the 19th century English working class, and the bourgeois family with a one breadwinner was, under these conditions, not an empirical phenomenon. So it's not just to criticize Marx, he didn't care about women. So it's quite interesting why this bourgeois family arose at all. What still remains problematic is that Marx comprised the reproduction of the labor force from the viewpoint of capital, so it provides a minimum of need satisfaction regardless of their form and quality. So in short, he treated capital as a genderless force. And on the other end, he clarified that without political struggle, capital would provide only the bare minimum of means for production of labor power, leisure times, forms and costs of production. The value and forms of labor force are not deductible from capitalist surplus production, but a contested ground for political movements and the state. So I just want to make clear, for productive and reproductive labor, I really, if I say unproductive labor, it's not a moral concept, it's an analytical concept, how wage work contributes to surplus value. So surplus value is productive work and not unproductive in the terms of, you're in the service sector or you're laboring in care work, so you are unproductive, you're producing nothing. So I'm not into this. I'll just try to shorten it a bit. So what happened was that capitalism as a genderless force sets up the problem that it's basically women have disadvantages because of their potentiality to give birth to children, and biological reproduction didn't really fit into this, and the state has to jumps in to organize and reorganize this fact. And especially this case that women have the potentiality to give birth and are for other ideological reasons caged in the sphere of reproductive labor became a contested ground for queer feminists, because they tried to criticize socialist feminists for being essentialist. And I think it's really necessary to analyze how capitalism does gender. So it's not a question of linguistics, but of an objectivity that does gender. So I have 5 minutes, and I just want to give you an insight. What changed in Germany so far? Because there is nearly no politics I know of in the left who is directly attacking reproduction, what's happening is the most strongest movements right now are basically coming from migrants who organized a huge march into the capital of Berlin fighting for their rights. So there is a huge alliance against the crisis set up in Frankfurt. So let me outline reproductive politics in Germany. So due to the Marshall Plan and the German Wirtschaftswunde, the one breadwinner family was reestablished after women, due to the lack of labor power, had entered the labor market after the Second World War and partly during National Socialism. Feminist movements that claim for an integration of women in the labor market and do so today interpreted this era as one of relative freedom, despite the fact that they profited women from a fascist, racist, and anti-Semitic regime. Only recently, women began to critically reassess the role of women during National Socialism, for example. So this perspective on emancipation of women as labor had other theoretical problems. So beginning in the post-war period, we find social relations and forms of everyday life increasingly subordinated to the prerogatives of consumer capitalism that brought, for the most part of Germans, a relatively high standard living. after the Stunde Null, the ideology of beginning from scratch, women didn't possess full legal rights. They were excluded from any major contractability, such as land, housing, cars, and could not demand divorce. Privacy and the family was revisited as the uncorrupted, non-political island after the world had fallen down. In Germany, women, as in the US, Maya Gonzalez writes this too, configured a reserve army for workers, temporarily and precariously plugged into capital, supplying it with flexible and expendable labor. Women's, there in the 70s and 80s, self-organized forms of care work for children were organized, known as the Kinderladenbewegung, but the integration into the labor market had not been realized, but only in the past 10 years this occurred. So just give you a few numbers. In 1960, there were 49% of women on the labor market. In 2000, it was 57.5%. And reproduction has become a contested ground, and it is the European Union forces women into the labor market. The Declaration of the European Union on Gender and Labor states, "Europe's workforce is shrinking as a result of demographic change, and thereby a smaller workforce is supporting a growing number of dependents. The Europe strategy sets a goal of labor market participation of 75% for women and men aged 20 to 64. And the European Commission sets up goals which are to be fulfilled by every nation, otherwise there are fees. So in Germany, the rate of female employment, has risen to 71.8%, and it's the problem is what happened is a neoliberalization of parental benefits. For example, before 2007, parental benefit was granted to everybody independent from their income. Now we have a new called parental benefit, which is bound to the wage labor of the parents. That means you get 65% of your wage labor, and the minimum is 300 euros a month. So what happened was a new politics, which is essentially motivating well-educated women to get children and supporting rich families, whereas the losers of this development are single mothers, specifically single mothers, and students, self-entrepreneurs, precarious laborers. There is another so-called, there was a resistance against this by conservative politics, and they were backed astonishingly by the left, again, social democrats and the leftists. They called for a freedom of choice for women to stay in the household or go into the labor market. And this was a very problematic alliance because it justified its aim with stereotypical visions of female labor. And I think it's just worth to know that they were not successful. What happened was Germany introduced a so-called parental benefit as a premium. You get, if you decide to give not your child into the kindergarten of an age from 1 to 3, you get 100 euros a month. So it's like a symbolic act of maintaining that privileged families can afford a one caring labor. So the other thing, and I think this is even more important, is Pflegegeld, to care for people when you when they are old.
Hospice.
Yeah. So this is another privatization which is going on. We had due to the privatization of state-supported homes for the elderly, this care work is privatized, and you get a supportive, really very short, very little money, and predominantly this labor is done by women for about 500 euros a month. So it's I have to finish now. I will have to skip the political part. But what results of it, we can maybe discuss afterwards how the German left reacted to it and what the communization's ideas were about it. Sorry for being too long.
No, it's fine.
Sorry, I'm exceptionally bad at this.
Who wants to go next?
I could go next. I think that was a good kind of lead-in. So as I said, I'm attempting to sketch out the beginnings of a leftist position, either on architecture or within architecture, as architecture is often kind of framed as a space or discipline.
I'm sorry.
I explained earlier that I stutter, and that's what this is. So I am okay. I'm just not normal. as architecture is often framed as a space or a discipline, which exists kind of on top of the actual profession of architecture and the building industry, which it kind of manages and interacts with. This contemporary context I'll characterize as being covering completely or even impossibly postmodern, and however incoherently or dishonestly postmodernists. And this allows you to accept a conception of modernity, which can move my check out. A conception of modernity that begins with the Renaissance and with the concurrent development of bourgeois capitalism, and the humanist conceptions of subject. Explicitly tied, especially in art and architecture, to neoclassicalist aesthetics and visual culture. And a revival of Platonist conceptions of abstract ideal form existing apart from the material world. Modernism, then I will take as being broadly the thinking of a of an anti-humanist mass objectivity and the embracing of, or at least acknowledgement of the social formations and constructions related to industrialization specifically and in general the which here was synthesis of a matter and form. This is really not working. I can usually talk better. Are you guys understanding me at all? I feel like I'm completely not communicating. I'm usually not this bad. And so the I'm trying to posit modernism as being basically, having the potential of being a materialist approach to architecture, and then also, and then also art, which not only refigures the art object or the architectural object, but also engages with the kind of function of art or architecture in constructing subject object relations and therefore making subject activity. In the paper I presented at the last historical materialism conference, I trace the history of the of left-wing German architects from the Bauhaus who went to the Soviet Union to help work on the first five-year plan, and the role of foreign specialists, and particularly in the in the project of designing a new city called Magnitogorsk, which was this super large factory complex in Western Siberia, built next to a mountain referred to as the Magnetic Mountain, which was kind of miraculously made of almost completely pure iron ore. And so in this project of making a new city, the idea of the Fortis assembly line was a applied not only to housing but to the whole city as this kind of urban social apparatus with the mines and the factories and the workers' housing. All in one giant assembly, and as the Germans had brought with them this idea of a modernist or materialist feminism, which had also kind of built into it. The valorization of productive work over reproductive work, where the hours spent in kind of housework and other kind of reproductive labor were seen as is wasted or encapsulated within the the space of the home. All of these industrial logics were looked to liberate liberate both the labor and the time of women, and to free them up to become industrial workers. And so with this, the architectural and urban project became one of both a completely integrated industrial system into the entire function of the city, and also using architecture to break down the family and to liquidate this that cultural form, and to build the new social relations Soviet society. And so kind of paradoxically, though, the focus or the point of this work ended up inverting the function of the factories from productive kind of use. And yes, they did make a lot of steel there. And the steel was a completely important for developing a modernist Soviet Union, and later winning the war. But the main focus of the the architecture work and design work became actually the reproduction of society, and so it was kind of work in factories less aimed at making steel than making making people into workers, making a proletarian mass subjectivity there. All of this ended in the later 30s with the increasingly to very nature of Stalinism becoming increasingly interested in this this kind of larger scale social reproduction, and inscribing over the or actually like oh 5 minutes. Okay, so socialist realism replaced this materialist conception of the of the way that architecture works in constructing objects. Activities with a realist aesthetic regime okay, so I've completely missed the bottom half of my paper. Where instead of operating in over symbols and signs and sign systems become the thing which constructs the subject for the looks of both art, architecture, and politics, and so design work becomes simple manipulation and the making of languages, and creation of sign systems, and so what I was hoping to argue argue was for socialist realism as being this early kind of foreshadowing of the postmodernist architecture, which appears in the West after the war, in this case with a mostly right-wing ideology behind it. And with the stakes of shutting down modernism and actually suppressing the materialist engagement with aesthetic and architectural issues, and this I feel has created a condition where in the liberal discourse, ideas of design and design thinking are kind of valorized as the most important kinds of reproductive labor, as the most important kinds of image. Material labor, and the kind of most important way of working in this role of social reproduction within the kind of image material information. economy, whereas architectural discourse has been captured by this kind of useless debate between a reactionary neoconservative positions, which teach, seek to reinscribe this humanist solidity of subject, and then the neoliberal kind of or I guess would be neoliberal icon makers and symbol producers. All the kind of vestiges of the old modernism are still tied to notions of industrial production and seek out the kind of limited fields of engagement where it's still useful to think in basically apolitical technocratic terms such as green architecture. To wrap up, I was hoping to instead to propose architectural practice and design work to hold the out the potential of actively engaging with its the reproductive aspects of the of the kind of work it is, and to think of how this can be a radical practice that is which can become the kind of active materialism of the new image, of the new regime of image real labor. Thank you.
Evan.
Go ahead.
Okay. So this comes out of a set of sort of translations and research I'm doing into a lot of otherwise untranslated Italian stuff from the sort of long 70s, particularly sort of communist feminism and a sort of weird illegalist councilism, very rare moment. And early operaismo stuff. So this is going to try to sort of sketch a different thought on the question of unwaged labor via these things. Okay, so the task of this talk is simple: to provide a different lineage of the major innovations of 70s Italian communist feminist analysis, particularly the critique of unwaged reproductive labor as centered in the family and home, and to present a maybe different take on just what's at stake in it. So that theory has continued to be as ignored by the general boys' club of Marxism as it was by the specific boys' club of Italian 70s commies, despite being as major an intervention into Marxism as it was in that local Italian situation. And at most, within that situation, it got read as the call for recognition within a movement, like the famous open letters to Lotta Continua that some people may know. When it has been taken seriously, the receptions come primarily from within the context of feminist histories, meaning that certain aspects of the critique and its sources have been stressed above others. And so the framing I'll offer is trying to clarify a bit how the critique, both as analysis and as political strategy, is neither an attempted corrective pose to state partners and comrades, nor is it a response divorced from the wider field of heterodox Italian Marxism. And above all, it's not the demand for wages for housework is not a plausible demand, nor was it a call to become waged, to prop up the couple form or family unit with state assistance. Rather, it's a further step up in a corrosive critique of the community of capital as such, a major advance in a general theory of subsumption and negativity that took shape across three decades and that can't be pinned to one theme, one writer, one nation, or one movement. And the significance of that step, the particular one taken by Dalla Costa, Fortunati, etc., and of the severe conclusions it posed regarding both the circuit of capital reproduction and the very specific hostility of gender, family, home, and love, is a significance we can measure by the direct proportion of awkward and palm-sweating silence it produced amongst those who refused to acknowledge it. So there are sort of three key lines of thought and historical shifts whose relation to unwaged labor theory has gone largely unacknowledged. The first two of these I'll save for another talk, because 20 minutes and all. So the first of those is a demographic argument that's raised by Dalla Costa and Fortunati in a remarkable book called Brutto Ciao. The title's a sort of piss take of the partisan song Bella Ciao. And there they bind the critique of unwaged reproductive labor to the material outmoding of the proletarian utility of childbearing, particularly both in terms of the incapacity of a new world war to absorb what they called carne di cannone, cannon meat, literally cannon fodder, or once you had the largest internal migration in the history of Europe, as you did from the Mezzogiorno, the south of Italy, into the Industrial Triangle, basically had an oversaturation of living labor. So there's sort of, in a way, the family is demographically outmoded, even as it persists as a social form. The second thing I'm not going to talk about as much today is the critica radicale, the radical critique current, linked, as I mentioned, to a kind of dissident councilism. It routes through the French reception of Bordiga back into northern Italy in groups like LUD, Organizzazione Consiliare, Comantismo, etc. What's quite striking about this is a defense of illegalism, including kind of advocacy of banditry, etc., but also an attention to seemingly anti-political forms of social negativity, like soccer riots and things like that, as well as a sort of attempt to take the question of class negativity into space. But again, I'll save those. Those are a related argument I'll save for another time. The third history that I'm going to talk about is the nominally better known operaismo, workerism, read here in terms of communist feminism both as a direct influence, particularly in the inheritance of the factory as a figure, not a site, and as a point of sort of useful contrast. Okay. So as with the other materials I'm working on, the Anglo and French and German reception of operaismo tends to be unfortunately constructed off the basis of a very few stray fragments that happen to have been translated, rather than, say, an actual translation of Tronti's Workers of Capital, which was supposedly about to come out in 1972. So now, you know, 40 years later, no sign of that coming. But the elements of its analysis got started in the late 50s, building into the Con Ricerca and the Workers' Inquiry of Ranieri Panzieri and Romano Alquati around the turn of the 60s. The decisive point for their analysis, its sort of weird, unexpected proof, was the infamous Turin metalworkers' strike and subsequent Piazza Statuto riots in 62. And this moment is pretty well known among certain crews. Following a general strike of the metalmeccanici in Turin, the Unione Italiana del Lavoro and SIDA, who is the Fiat-specific union, they basically cut their own deal with management to resume production behind the backs of workers, who were unsurprisingly pissed, and a relatively small number of them, or small in terms of Italian social war, so 7,000, went to Piazza Statuto to protest, And there it exploded beyond any semblance of a sort of managed inter or intra-union struggle, basically barricades, storms torn up and thrown at cops, 1,000 or so arrests. So the expected condemnations came from the PCI, the PSI, and the unions about lack of discipline, an incorrect way of fighting, breaking rank with union and party. And in short, the official Italian left proved totally unable and unwilling to grapple with the sort of surprising hostility of these new hordes of apparently apolitical, unskilled laborers. And at this point, the mass worker, operaia massa, warts and knives and all, turned up unmistakably on the national stage. As Organizzazione Consiliare, one of the dissident illegalist councilist groups, put it later regarding another revolt, quote, "The proletariat's solitude and the obscene and grinning face of its insurrections leave its oppressors and false protectors dismayed." And Mario Tronti wrote later, quote, "As a matter of urgency, we must get hold of and start circulating a photograph of the worker proletariat that shows him, problem here, as he really is, proud and menacing." Turin in 62 was a sort of blurry photo of that, but not menacing in the way that anyone thought it was supposed to be. So that event and its fallout marked an irrevocable split. And that's a split between the fundamental negativity of class and the mechanisms of negation, from unions to riots, parties to absenteeism, that sought to, or just did, give articulation. And so by negativity of class, I mean both, on one hand, the basic drive to unmake the very world that you help pile high, and more technically, the process of decomposition that follows from persistent splits, splits intrinsic to the social relation of capital, namely, one is both owner and the media machinery that you own, one is both singular instance and instance of class, one is both labor and labor power, and also the splits of specific historical processes, like the machinic descaling of work. And so it's this split between negativity of class and mechanisms of negation that become for Operaismo first a crucial point of analysis, as in the mass worker is an embodiment of abstract labor, and second, a sort of project of separation to be pursued in the form of class autonomy, not just from capital, but from itself. In Tronti's words, quote, "The separation of the working class from itself as wage labor, and hence from capital." Or, more simply, in other words, proletariat, class not as essence, but as process of negation. But here we should note that the response of the Operaisti to Piazza Statuto, despite recognizing its sea change importance, nevertheless missed two really crucial aspects, ones that the communist feminism in the 70s got a lot better. So first, the impasse in a union-articulated struggle over time, namely adequate pay as recompense for one's laboring hours, was answered spatially in exiting both the factory for the city and the wage battle for the street battle. And second, and most obviously, was the excessive focus on the waged worker, binding the social crisis back to the particular site, role, and gender of labor left behind. So the general current I want to identify within Operaismo that I think is of crucial import to thinking about this critique of unwaged work is threefold. Okay, first, a declaration of the total non-neutrality, i.e. the proper subsumption into the circuit of capital, of what the socialist tradition misread as potentially neutral, rational, objective, and therefore able to be incorporated into the process of communism, most notably means of production, right? Two, an understanding of this non-neutrality, especially that of the fundamental antagonism of the proletariat, in terms of a process termed il piano di capitale, the plan of capital. And three, an attempted exacerbation of the split between labor power and the class of labor, on which the plan of capital turns, an attempt to exacerbate that towards class autonomy via the refusal of work and, crucially, the rejection of the generic humanity of the proletariat. The human strike stuff comes almost entirely from this, but it goes unacknowledged, I think, by the way. So in order, running through these. First, the issue of non-neutrality is present in the very first writings, especially in Panzieri and Alquati. In Panzieri's famous riposte to objectivists, he makes clear what now seems totally fucking obvious to all of us, that the history of productive technology does not follow its own rationality, but intertwines ceaselessly with transformations in capital. One cannot just build up means of production in hopes of eventual takeover without simultaneously thickening the built rule of capital. In Alquati, the non-neutrality is management itself, including seemingly neutral arrangements that he kind of reveals as direct expressions of the social forms of capital. In Alberto Assorosa, cutting too close to the comfort of many, it's intellectuals who are revealed as non-neutral. And in Tronti, most strikingly, it's labor power itself no longer held up as a, quote, form-giving fire, as Marx's term, to be freed, but the thing to be severed and refused. And finally, with the communist feminists in the 70s, it'll be that last bastion of supposed comfort. Not just the home where the dirty laundry's washed, as one text put it, not just the family where male workers get to play boss, but love itself. Two, the second kernel drawn from Obrerismo, is the primary and often forgotten center of that thought was an engagement with the concept of il piano, the plan. This has almost been entirely lost in the kind of Anglo-reception of this. Now, in a way, this comes out of a very real fact of Italian neo-capitalism, that's Ernst Mandel's term, which designated quite simply a heightened degree of collaboration between state, industry, and union leaders, especially in Confindustria, which was a sort of super group of industrialists and state leaders, etc., plus increased investment in infrastructural and energy products. But the analytical push lies elsewhere for Operaismo. First, the historical analyses of Red Vienna, the Werkbund, the German Werkbund, and city planning that appeared later around the Venice School, Cacciari, Tafori, etc. And second, and more potently for this, in Negri and Tronti's work on the Keynesian recognition and management of working class negativity. So for Negri's periodization, that recognition emerges in fits and starts throughout the 19th century, but with the Paris Commune, it's unmistakable. It's followed by waves of revolutionary activity up to the 1910s, as the class consolidates as subject. But then it's fixed in place as piano. Piano means plan, but also the ground, the plane, by the Keynesian solution. Basically, what happens, capital recognizes the working class as a historical force that you can't simply ignore or fight, and via uncoupling of the wage from free market determination and the application of managed crises, it makes class hatred the motor of its own development. So the heart of this move, which is basically Keynes's recognition of downward wage rigidity, was for Tronti, quote, the most important discovery of Western Marxism, and it's the crux of his own Copernican turn, because, simply, it means that the value of labor, as well as for the development of productive forces, is going to be dictated by class antagonism, and labor literally becomes his own worst enemy. So stepping back, the general importance for Operaismo of this moment, this sort of thick moment of the 30s, is basically that it marks the real subsumption not of labor by capital, but of the working class into capital. Working class here meaning at once a material concept, a real population, and a project of antagonism. So this is historically dependent, according to Negri, on a preceding period of the real subsumption of labor into capital. Sorry, I have here first. The real subsumption, basically, you'd say, of labor power into class. And prior to that would be the real subsumption of labor into capital. So real subsumption of labor into capital, real subsumption of labor power into class formation, that's when it becomes an antagonistic subject, real subsumption of that class into capital, in the piano del capitale. That's the sort of Negrian, back when he was cool, the three-step term, right? So this historical sequence is the heart of the two major separations taken as coordinates for the 1960s. One's of real significance, I think, for thinking unwaged labor. Okay, very simply, one, as I mentioned, is the separation of wage from labor time. Second, and following from this, is the separation of labor and labor power, and through the refusal of work, the project of trying to extend this. So to return to the kind of quickly the Trontian point in this, he argues that, quote, the simple worker must become indifferent to his own labor so that the working class can come to hate it. Only in its generically human figure can labor power voluntarily submit itself to capital. Only as human needs do workers' demands become freely accepted by the capitalist. It is this point in which the worker definitively discovers the cult of man as a bourgeois sham. Interestingly, you get the same comments in Carl Schmitt, and Tronti said, we need both Carls, Schmitt and Marx. So Schmitt also is another precursor of a sort of human strike, practical anti-humanism. So because the proletarian is not defined as human, but rather the human in its zero point is defined by the proletarian as a machine of living labor, which is the only measurable proof of vital productivity, the class that comes to hate labor through the withdrawal of its labor power means that it comes to hate the human. Yet despite steps taken toward what Marx called the hidden abode of production within Operaismo, or Operaismo's steps toward that, and a proper critique of living labor as such, that abode will remain, indeed, still fixed on a very different cult of man, in the center of a factory without end, unable to take a proper step into the literally hidden abode of production, namely the home, except for a quick dinner before the editorial meeting. So, how do these elements of... How am I doing it, Tom? Should take a bit? Wrap it up?
Yeah, I guess.
Whatever. Okay, so then I'll just go. Fuck it. So how do these elements of operaismo interface with an analysis of unwaged reproductive labor? The concrete way in is through subsumption. Now, when one speaks of subsumption in a Marxist register, we primarily mean, as mentioned before, the historical tendency from the primary extraction of absolute surplus value, lengthening workday, etc., toward relative surplus value, from the formal subsumption of labor toward the real subsumption of labor, the productive apparatus of the factory being the concrete and sort of path-blazing manifestation. But crucially, this also bears on what Rubin speaks of as the link between concrete and social labor and capital. Because even if concrete labor produces goods of social necessity, one cannot divide a commodity cleanly in terms of its use value and exchange value, preserving the former as the portion for social utility, ready to be cracked free from value via self-management for full flowering of communal use. Instead, according to Rubin, I think he's right on this, social labor passes through abstraction, through the relations of what he calls social equalization. And moreover, it passes through a relation of the universal, in which the very nature of one's individual work, regardless of what you feel about it, is its universality. This is a point Marx makes when he says, quote, the labor time of a single individual is directly expressed in exchanged as universal labor time, and this universal character of individual labor is the manifestation of its social character. Okay, so read in terms of the robot factory called the home, or the meat machine factory, and debates about whether or not it's value-producing, one version might be to read the family as something like an assemblage of social labor, literally fed by waged inputs, whether the family wage of the early to mid-19th century or individual breadwinner model. Reproductive work would then, in this model, be something like concrete social labor, directly reproducing labor power that subsequently enters the market where it participates as both concrete and abstract labor. This would be mistaken, I think, fully, because the same passage of concrete into social labor via abstract labor happens without the wage. It passes through abstraction, but it does not do so as waged work that happens to go unwaged. It has its own quality, its own temporality, and launches its own critique of the system that conditions it. And so to gesture towards this, I'm going to kind of borrow from a text I translated called On the Construction of Feminist Committees from Comitato Veneto from 75. That I think poses really remarkably what the specificity of this critique would be without saying, like, no, it is value producing, not reducing it to a version of the wage, but getting what's precise about this. Okay, first, and this sort of links, I think, to questions Alan's raising, that, and I've talked to them about before, is the spatial. I mentioned the way in which the problem of Piazza Statuto was that a problem of time was answered in space. This is something really understood by that feminist moment. So, quote, the house within which we perform the main part of such labor is atomized inside thousands of four walls, but it's present everywhere, in the country, in the city, in the mountains, etc. The metropolis is our large factory, these are their quotes, our large factory. The city is our medium factory. The village is our little factory. So this is perhaps the most extreme version of a solution of the problem of time, coming undone of wage and labor, in terms of space. But it runs in reverse from the motion of capital, which takes the grotesque interpenetration of capital and labor in the factory and extends it outward. That's the basic idea of the social factory. Against misreadings, though, this isn't a reach of that into the home. It's a flipping of that logic the other way, back out from the hidden abode of production. And crucially, this proliferation doesn't arrive through demolishing the four-wall space into all the private zones, the Bretonian fantasy of the glass house, for example, the end of privacy, but through a sort of blurry multiplying overdetermination. The horror of the house is present everywhere, and it emerges from a claustrophobic parataxis that is a placing side by side, one that then collapses in on itself. And that parataxis doesn't leave those incompatible elements as stably distinct. It doesn't redefine the house, that contradiction that runs rampant through the metropolis, as equivalent to the logic of the industrial factory. Instead, it drives a redefinition in which labor is not first and foremost industrial, but equally first and foremost domestic. The large factory is a metropolis, the medium factory is a city, the little factory is a village. Making anew and managing the made are rendered conceptually proximate, and they become a category error. And with that blur in plain sight, it becomes clear that no shift in perspective, will change the facts on the ground. Only a rearrangement of materials, ourselves entirely included, to the point that perspective has to realign with it, will achieve this. Second, quickly, is I think the particular temporality of unwaged reproductive labors they're talking about. So, quote, from this struggle, this is from the same text I mentioned, from this struggle, one that was able to redefine in a certain sense the material conditions of life for us women, insofar as it has imposed a break on the last time cuts into our working day, from this struggle that built a first breakwater of defense to let us catch our breath and keep our heads above the flood of labor, from this struggle we had to begin. We constructed a dam of defense, end quote. So, aside from these sort of general aquatic metaphors, I actually think this term, the flood of labor, is a precise one. It's a technical one. It's not just figurative. It's actually nailing something really importantly. Namely, it's another timescale of modernity, a quotidian flow of capital. And it lacks the clarity of division that marked the male workers' movement, the 888 of 19th century industrial reform, 8 hours of work, 8 hours of leisure, 8 hours of rest. That was the sort of formula. Instead, the working day means the working day as a 24-hour unit. But then there's sort of two key issues. Do we see this work as entirely determined by capital? Clearly, it isn't rationalized in the sense that a factory is. It's not really subsumed in accordance with the circuit of value, insofar as that means of becoming identical to abstract labor. But it also makes no sense to see it as somehow indifferent to this total process, or, as I was saying, to frame it as the sort of circuitous wage, as if it is wage labor just via sort of arcane pathways. Instead, I want to say that rather than seeing it as a wage waiting to happen, you have to recognize it's a place that capital cannot marketize because it provides one of the three fundamental thefts of time and capital. So the first theft of time is the wage, obviously. The second comes under the sign of race and the nation, basically colonial extraction via the sign of zones of other governance, etc., primitive accumulation. And the third is love and the family, basically, which basically provides a veil or screen that naturalizes the extraction of time. So this, for me, changes the understanding of the demand, not just because it couldn't be answered politically, because there was no way in hell that either the Italian state or Italian male workers' movement was going to do shit about this, but also capital cannot ever answer this, because it needs the veil of love and family to cover over this theft of time. And in this way, that demand places an impossible logical position. A flood of labor without division and beneath the sign of social reproduction, caring for your partner, raising children, etc., comes to be unwaged abstract labor. Beneath the sign of abstraction, all the more for being without obvious quantification, the exchange of the wage, the breakup of the day. And we might here then venture a definition of unwaged reproductive work. It's formally subsumed labor that, by means of remaining unwaged, produces the conditions through which abstract labor, and hence the accumulation of capital, is actually possible. And lastly, I'll end here.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'll stop there. Fine.
No, it's awesome. Thanks. Okay. All right. Well, we don't have that much time.
We do. Go to the
40 minutes. for questions, and I guess just raise your hand or something. We could take stack, I don't know.
Nothing.
Can I start with the last point that ends?
Yeah.
Just to the unwaged abstract labor, could you elaborate a little bit?
Yeah.
On that, like formally subsumed, but sustaining really subsumed labor.
Yeah.
And I thought that is actually the slot for the material side of ideology. Because, as you said, capitalism cannot work rationally. Just say, here, you just reproduce after labor time, after labor in a certain amount of time, like 8 hours, it needs the veil. The veil is
capital. Exactly.
That's what neo-Marxists called necessary force consciousness,
yeah,
as a material force in the place of reproduction.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, and I'm still thinking about this, but that I'm trying to sort of get at with that is a way in which, simply because something, you know, so in the tradition I didn't talk about as much, you know, that I was saying this sort of weird Italian councilism, this sort of strange moment. They, coming out of the sort of French reception I mentioned of Bordiga and things like that, like they want to talk not just about the real subsumption of labor, but then the idea of like the real domination of capital. You know, they have a shift towards sort of social domination. And although that gets into sort of tricky territory about sometimes seeing states as sort of controlling the puppets of capital, which is just not true, what is useful in understanding is that you can't simply see the circuits of abstract labor as determined by the wage. Instead, it's a sort of total process. That's why I'm interested in that, the moment I was saying, where there's the subsumption of class into capital. In Kamat's terms, for example, this would be the rise of the monetary community of capital. So you basically have also like a material ideology, the built world of capital, its circuits of reproduction. So I'm trying to sort of sidestep a bit some of these debates about like, is unwaged work technically value producing or not? You know, at the end of the day, like, I'm maybe not entirely interested in that question because I think it misses the point that it has a precise specificity that cannot be waged. Like that's, you know, love, I mean it very seriously. It's like you need wage, you need nation, and you need love. And without any one of those three, it becomes incredibly difficult for capital to accumulate at a level it needs, like, you know, 3% globally a year or whatever. So, you know, for me, this, what I'm trying to get at there basically is to say that it's work that is neither waged nor fully kind of subsumed whatsoever in this way. But insofar as I'm taking Rubin's point about his sort of attack on the ability to make a clear division between sort of concrete and abstract labor, right? That if we take the idea of the flood seriously, that you no longer get clear divisions internal to this, there's something like a kind of, this sounds metaphorical, but I take metaphors seriously, something like a fog of abstraction, right? In this real way where like it casts over everything. You don't get the pleasure of saying like, I'm working now, I'm performing abstract labor, now I'm consuming. The point, you know, and if you read all of the, you know, the texts in that period, they stress is that there's nothing that allows a moment of division. Simultaneously, an act of love is also the reproduction of that which can perform abstract labor. So, you know, I think in a weird, like, it may be that ultimately the application of the framework that emerges from an analysis of waged work doesn't apply to this, you know, and maybe that'll be dropped. But in trying to square some of these categories, that's how I see it, that you have something like abstract labor without the wage, or without it having to be determined by the wage.
You know, the way that I read that, or what you had said, yeah, was really interesting, but in a totally different way, is that, like, this, the home sets up kind of a diachronic, like,
yeah,
temporal, sort of hourly, I don't know, it's not abstract time, but there is something about, like, universal
totally, it's yeah,
time.
Yeah.
And then across that, with real subsumption, you get more of the synchronic, like, within 1 minute, mm-hmm, then you can break that up.
That's
into
really
even,
yeah,
fewer.
Yeah.
But it requires the 24-hour day,
yes,
in order to even have real subsumption or the breakdown of...
Precisely. This is the perversity of when people talk about, like, oh, you know, like, the factory never sleeps, right? The idea of the 24-hour factory. It's always predicated on, like, the other factory of the home becoming a 24-hour space, you know? And there is, you know, of course, a shift from... You know, on your recommendation, when I was reading the Wally Sacombe and then tracking down some of the other stuff, I mean, a really important point raised about that is, you know, in the first Industrial Revolution, contrary to certain accounts, like, you actually have an explosion of craft production at home, right? It's not the idea that, like, the first stage of that just is a unilateral push towards things in the factory. What you actually have is the factory needs its supplement of the other factory at home to kind of produce round the clock and to basically finish the labor it can't manage. So, no, I mean, I think what you're saying is a better reading of myself than what I'm giving, you know, like, because that seems precisely right, that there's basically this sort of a flood that can be marketized in little moments. You know, what I left out that's key...
That's the thing.
Yeah, and what I left out at the very end, I think, is important, is when they talk about what the form of resistance is, they say it's a really particular phrase, and it's not idiomatic in Italian, so again, it's like a technical term. They say, le virgole di tempo, the commas of time, and this is not idiomatic. They say, within this day, within this sort of flood of time, there are commas of time we can use to organize. Now, what they mean by that in a very literal way is like the moments on the stairwell, when you like run into your neighbor, when you borrow flour, when you go out to the shopping. It's like little moments in that. But what's really key is that it's something that lacks the idea of like the period, or like, I went to work, I went to the meeting, I went to the riot. Instead, it attempts to organize on the basis of like these little hitches and pause in that. So in the flood, like the best you can go for is something like these little moments that wrench things out of time, that become basically out of the sort of the hypotaxis, basically, of the of this sort of flood of time, this endless subordination. You try to basically wrench things apart, not in order to then say, now it's wage work, now it's not, but to kind of dissolve the entire system, you know. Mm.